I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. A revised executive order signed by President Donald Trump yesterday removes Iraq from the list of countries whose nationals will face restrictions on entering the United States. The order, effective March 16th, still restricts travel from Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. It replaces a previous set of restrictions that were halted by a federal court order. Today, we discuss immigration directives coming from the White House and changes to foreign worker visa programs and how they might impact many businesses in our region. In studio, Matthew Lee, an immigration attorney who aids corporate clients in obtaining highly skilled foreign professionals. He's also an expert on the H-2B visa program and is a former assistant district counsel for the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Minnie. Thanks for having me again.
You've worked on both sides of this issue. So let's start with how this updated travel ban might impact the clients you work with.
Well, it is just a It is a revision of the initial foreign terrorist executive order that was issued back in January 27th, and it softens some of the language and takes out the provisions that were found by numerous courts, federal courts across the country, that were found to be unconstitutional. So they, again, like you said, they take the Iraqis off the list, and then they ask for more vetting of the visa process. The part that was found to be illegal was obviously you can't deny people entry into the United States that were already issued. They were already vetted by a U.S. consulate, given a visitor's visa or any type of non-immigrant visa to come back in. And also you can't prevent people that were already awarded their green cards and that have lawful permanent resident status just because they're from one of these six or seven countries from returning to the United States. So those two provisions were struck down. This the new executive order softens some of the language, but it does it does still create a extreme vetting, whatever that means, of people from these countries.
President Trump's original executive order had many stranded at airports. It disrupted businesses and institutions globally and faced many, as you said, federal lawsuits. Do you anticipate that this one's going to be challenged in the courts as well?
I'm sure it will be. The problem with all these executive orders is that there's a undercurrent of discrimination, and that is found by and the judges across the country have said they've actually taken into account the president's statements and his tweets, where he specifically singles out Muslims, which is discriminatory, and that this new executive order tries to cleanse and make it facially neutral, but you can't take back what was said in the last 60 days, preferring Christian Syrian refugees and specifically saying Muslim terrorists.
So. Yeah. So there have been three executive orders. You want to sum up for us what they were?
Sure. January 25th, two executive orders were signed. The Interior Safety executive order was basically making criminal illegal aliens and criminal green card holders an enforcement priority for deportation. Part of that was also asking the Office of Management and Budget to monitor federal funds provided to sanctuary communities, basically a lever point for the federal government to get state and local law enforcement to enforce immigration priorities. There was the second executive order was the Border Security Act, and this was the executive order that asked for creation of the wall, the southern border wall, to detain people based on suspicion of violation of immigration laws, expedited deportation, detain all those people that are going to be deported, removed promptly, and again, to enact partnership agreements between federal and state and local law enforcement to get the assistance of local law enforcement to enforce immigration laws. And then the last one was on February 27th, the Foreign Terrorist Act. Again, this barred anybody that was given a non-immigrant visa or a green card from these seven countries. It barred them from coming back. That was all struck down by federal courts. And then yesterday was the revised version that we just discussed.
Yeah. We're going to get into some more of this, but I want to go into a little bit of history here. 10 years ago yesterday, hundreds of undocumented immigrants working illegally in a leather goods factory in New Bedford were arrested by federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Most immigrants caught up in the raid were deported, but Carolina was allowed to stay. Her story is brought to us by independent producer Virginia Laura.
Carolina remembers the day. It was March 6, 2007, early in the morning. Carolina arrived at the Michael Bianco factory in New Bedford. She sat in front of her sewing machine and got to work. A few hours into her shift, all the entrances to the factory were blocked. Suddenly, officers in dark uniforms barged in. Everyone was ordered not to move.
Entraron así bien equipado la gente y yo te
sé. They came in, weapons and all, and I remember thinking, what's going on? And another woman shouting something at me. And when I looked, everyone was running to hide.
Carolina didn't hide. She says she just sat there, trying to stay calm. On instinct, she pulled out her cell phone and dialed her babysitter.
I said to her, I don't know what's happening, what they're looking for, maybe drugs, who knows, but please, please take care of my baby.
She hung up. Then she heard officers yelling for people without documents to line up. Only then did she think, oh my God, this is immigration. The raid was conducted by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE for short. Hundreds of agents swarmed the premises. There were helicopters outside and Coast Guard ships standing by. It was the largest immigration raid in Massachusetts at the time. In total, 361 undocumented immigrants were arrested. Carolina was one of them. Carolina is from Guatemala. A few years ago, she fled the country because it was not a safe place. She left her 2-year-old son behind with his grandmother. Carolina says it was an incredibly difficult choice, but she had to. She had to come to New Bedford to join her husband, who had immigrated earlier. Plus, and maybe more importantly, she had hoped she could eventually provide a better future for her son. Instead, she found herself on a factory floor, in handcuffs. Over the course of the day, Carolina and the others arrested were loaded on several buses. They were sent to an ICE facility for initial processing and fingerprinting.
And I kept trying to cheer up the other women. You know, don't cry, we're going to get out. I was like a rock. And that made me shut off my own pain and not shed a single tear until much later.
But even as she cheered the others on, Carolina began to feel uneasy. Later that night, during the customary ICE medical examination, she was anxious. She felt a pressure on her chest. Carolina asked the nurse for the time. 3 a.m., she said.
That's the time my daughter wakes up and I breastfeed her, and that's why I feel this anguish. My daughter is suffering. This is when she eats and I'm not there, and I know she's looking for me.
Women with nursing babies at home were provided special treatment. Instead of being sent to a detention center, they were allowed to return to their children while they waited for their court hearings. But Carolina remembers they were asked for proof. They had to show photos of their babies, or go into a bathroom and show an officer they could produce milk from their breast. She says immigration officers eventually decided she could go home. She left relieved and in shock. Back in her home, Carolina was in bad shape. As the days went by, she says she became more and more depressed.
I had nightmares, was anxious. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I locked myself away.
But she knew she needed help. It took a long time and a great deal of effort, but she eventually found a pro bono lawyer to help her with her case. In order to help her, the lawyer needed all the details about her life in Guatemala. But Carolina had a hard time discussing them.
I'd say to the attorney, when bad things happen to me, I throw them aside. I don't want them with me. I want to look forward. I don't want to remember sad things about the past. A lot of people end up suicidal or killing themselves. You've got to look forward.
But her lawyer kept telling her she couldn't help her unless she knew the whole story. So finally, Carolina began to open up, and then felt even worse. Carolina says that when she started talking about what had happened to her, she got sick. She would get headaches, feel dizzy. She was referred to a psychologist and says sometimes after going over the details of her past, she would need to take pills to calm down. Eventually, her lawyer was able to draw the whole story out of her and realized Carolina might qualify for asylum.
Gracias a Dios, Ahora ya soy residente.
Carolina is now a legal permanent resident. Her story has many twists and turns, but in the end, her asylum application was approved, and she was allowed to stay. Why? Because she's Mayan. An ethnic indigenous group, the Maya, suffered a genocide during the Guatemalan Civil War. Beyond that conflict, Carolina herself was violently targeted and abused. In the end, a federal immigration judge deemed it unsafe for her to return to Guatemala.
Allá en Guatemala pasó una guerra terrible.
There was the terrible war, and I remember hiding and my mom telling me to be quiet, and I was there silently trembling. Later, I'd walk past the ditch where they buried the bodies. I lived in shock.
Yo, ahí temblando, yo calladita.
Carolina's story is a little ironic. She had been living in fear of being arrested and deported. But it was actually the arrest during the Michael Bianco raid that led to her becoming a legal permanent resident. Despite the violence she endured in her home country, leaving her 2-year-old son behind almost broke her heart. So, when she became a legal resident, Carolina petitioned the U.S. government for him to move to the United States and join her. By then, he was 17. They granted her request. She vividly remembers seeing her son for the first time at Logan Airport.
I was nervous when I saw him. I didn't know if to cry or to laugh.
How did Carolina even recognize him after 15 years? His grandmother had sent a picture, and she also memorized the clothes his grandmother told her he'd be wearing.
And I saw him from afar, and he smiled, and I smiled, so I knew that's him.
Here in the U.S., Carolina's son has had to adjust to a new life, new family dynamics, including living with a younger sister he hadn't met before. Carolina is happy to have her family together, but she worries for her kids, that they do well in school, that they stay out of trouble, and that they know they can talk to her about their problems. These days, Carolina works at a textile factory. She gets paid overtime, vacation, and sick days. But she feels deeply for those who are undocumented and continue to endure rough working conditions, like some of her friends, or neighbors, or other people she knows, living and working in New Bedford.
You live in fear that at any moment immigration can come. It's even worse for those who have families, because who will take care of them, of your kids? I lived it, so I identify with them.
In New Bedford, I'm Virginia Laura.
A piece was produced by Virginia Laura as part of the Transom Story Workshop. Listening to that story, Matthew Lee, we're talking about Matthew Lee in studio, it goes to show how complicated these individual cases can be. And I'm thinking of this expedited process, the deporting process they're talking about. People like Carolina might not get their cases heard, right?
Well, they'll get their cases heard eventually.
Eventually.
And that's in Boston Immigration Court, which handles the entire Northeast region pretty much, has currently a 5-year backlog to get your first initial hearing before the judge. That's how shorthanded they are with judges and prosecutors and even just court space in Boston.
Yeah. So in that 5 years, are you allowed to stay in the country or are you deported?
You are allowed to stay in the country.
All right. Joining us on the phone is Helena De Silva Hughes. She's the executive director of the Immigrants Assistance Center in New Bedford. Good morning, Helena.
Good morning.
So as we remember the fear after that raid 10 years ago, and as we hear some of these directives coming from the White House, you're seeing a lot of fear and angst again from people that your agency serves. Tell us what's happening.
Absolutely. And firstly, it's important to mention that the Michael Bianco raid that happened 10 years ago has left an open wound. And that is something that we can never forget. And I think that, and I know that because of everything that's going on with all these executive orders, and I actually would say right after President Trump got elected, we are seeing a heightened fear of in the schools, clients coming in, clients calling, and it's a very real situation for these families, and I think it just brings back the nightmare that a lot of these immigrant families faced during the raid. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing about all of this is that real, you know, real. I really believe that it just forces this undocumented population further underground, mm-hmm. And then a lot of crimes get unreported.
Yeah.
And that has always been my biggest fears, and it's still, and that is presently what's going on. And yes, some, in this particular case that you just mentioned, you know, that client, she was able to get asylum, and sometimes they are able to get U visas depending on what happened to them. But a lot of times the fear is overpowering them, that they just get so afraid, and they are an easy target.
Yeah.
And they become victims of crimes, and these crimes are getting unreported. And at the end, we don't. It's not safety for the community in general.
Yeah, you were telling me that some families are actually keeping their children home from school.
Yes. Well, they're afraid. They're really afraid. And I think it's important to mention that during the Marco Bianco raid, a lot of the women basically told ICE that they didn't have any kids because they were afraid that immigration was going to take away their mm-hmm. children. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be, what's happening right now is some of these families are afraid to send the kids to school, which they're afraid that if something happens to them, that their kids will be taken away. And I think that is, that fear is very much alive, and we see it. And when we talk to these families, is that, you know, we are constantly telling them that they need to send their children to school, that their children are safe in school. But I think the fear is if something happens to them, they want to know that their kids are not outside, that there is their home in a safe place, which is...
Helena, let me ask you about the scams, because I know you've recently talked about people need to be wary of people who are saying, I can help you get a green card,
exactly.
I can do these things faster, because they can't.
Exactly. And we see this abuse constantly, this abuse, and not just by notarios. We're actually seeing it with lawyers who are not immigration lawyers, who will say that they can help them do their papers. And I'm saying, well, there are no papers that can be done right now.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's actually members of their own community that are the biggest scam artists. And so that's the part that we really need to be very careful. And I know that through the Attorney General's office, Mara Hilly, I mean, that was one of the first things that she passed, was that 1-800 line, that if they are victims of crimes or scams or any of this, that it's important though that they report them. And
yeah.
That's the sad thing about it, is many times it's members of their own community.
Yeah. Hey, we're talking about immigration directives and changes to foreign worker visa programs. We'll have to have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about immigration directives, and in a little bit we'll be talking about changes to foreign worker visa programs. In studio with us, Matthew Lee, an immigration attorney who aids corporate clients in obtaining highly skilled foreign professionals. He's also an expert on the H-2B visa program and a former assistant district counsel for the Immigration and Naturalization Service. On the phone we have Helena Da Silva Hughes. She's the executive director of the Immigrants Assistance Center. And also joining us on the phone is Thomas Hodgson, Bristol County Sheriff. Good morning, Sheriff.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Sheriff, we mentioned earlier the focus on those who commit crimes being deported. But what's the bar for that? Is it any type of crime? I mean, is it like a traffic violation, or is it more serious? Where do we draw that line?
Well, they're generally focusing on the more serious crimes, the deportable offenses, or if someone's showing a criminal history, or they've reentered the country. Those are the kinds of things that Department of Homeland Security will be looking at.
Yeah. And Matthew, this is nothing new. I mean, this focus on serious crimes has been around for a long time.
Exactly. I mean, the when I was a INS prosecutor in court deporting people that were here illegally or committing crimes, that was 25 years ago. And for the 20 years preceding my job, so the last 40, 50 years, it's always been the number one priority of ICE and prior INS to go after those legal immigrants that are committing crimes that are deportable, and to go after those illegals that are committing crimes, to get those people off the streets and back to their own countries as quickly as possible. That has always been a priority, and the president has used the continuing same priority to rally his supporters that he's tough on immigration. President Obama deported more people in his 8 years than the preceding two presidents before him.
Mm.
Well, that's not completely true. The fact is that, and I think it's important to point out, President Obama changed the criteria for what a deportation was. Under Bush, if someone was caught at the border, they were considered a turnaway. President Obama, when he took over, decided to change the term of turnaway to a deportation. So that had something to do with the numbers as well.
Sheriff, talk us through the process of someone being detained and where ICE would become involved.
Well, first of all, if someone, for example, were arrested, brought to our facility, they would be queried across our database. They would be printed and queried across the FBI and Homeland Security database. If there is a hit at that point on that individual, a red flag, if you will, then what would happen is we would notify ICE, and ICE would make a determination as to whether or not they wanted to send someone here to conduct a more extensive interview and whether or not they wanted to hold them beyond that 48-hour period. So if they decide to detain them, there'd be a detention order placed on them, and then at that point they would go into ICE custody. Mm-hmm. If someone's here doing a sentence for a crime that they've committed and they complete the sentence, ICE may have, when they first arrive and begin their sentence, ICE may, once they were notified they were here, put ask for a detainer on them, so it would be marked in their file. Once their sentence is about to be completed, ICE is notified, and they'd be put into ICE detention.
Mm. Now, you're hoping that some of your officers will receive training paid for by the federal government that would essentially make them ICE agents. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the reason for that is that the way it is now, we would have to, once somebody is identified via the initial review of their prints, that ICE has an interest. We would have to wait till someone came down from Burlington, which might take some time. In the interim, that person could potentially be released on bail or get out before that ICE agent arrives. That person may very well be somebody that is has shown a history of criminal behavior up to, you know, murder or any other serious kind of crime, robbery or what have you. And we do not want those people getting back out into our community and weaving themselves back out into the fabric of our community so that they can commit more crimes or can avoid being detected, which would cost us obviously more money, taxpayers more money, more time, and law enforcement's efforts to locate them and bring them back into custody.
Again, Mindy, I would emphasize that this may be a new program for this particular sheriff's office, but back 25 years ago, I physically walked into Plymouth House of Correction, and we would do deportation proceedings in the House of Correction as people were being released on their state crime sentence, and detainers placed on them to go directly into INS custody in those days so that they would be deported. They would never hit the street. These programs have been around for 25 years.
Well, let me just add one thing to that. First of all, a lot has changed, as I'm sure you know, over the last 25 years in the way that Homeland Security has approached immigration issues. But I would we're speaking of the people that are coming in who are pretrials, people that have not been sentenced yet, who come in here as well, who potentially could get bailed out before ICE could make contact and do the appropriate interview. So this is really a force multiplier by having us be able to do the work and be certified by ICE as ICE agents to do that part of the interview.
Sheriff, are your officers actively seeking out undocumented people, or is it strictly those who are arrested for some other crime coming through the jail?
No, these are people that are brought to us. We have a regional lockup, so the cities and towns bring people to us, and we hold them until such time as, it's anybody in our county that's arrested. Come to us eventually. Yeah.
My concern, Mindy, is not the sheriff's offices, because at that point they've already been arrested or they brought to the attention of law enforcement. What concerns me about, and this is in a conversation I had this weekend with three police officers, what concerns me is the increased pressure put on states and local municipalities by withholding federal funds for local law enforcement. This is Falmouth police officers, to enforce immigration laws. That is the force multiplier that the president wants at the end of the day. It has taken the Massachusetts Division of Motor Vehicles 12 years to figure out and they do the best they can, but try to figure out the immigration status of someone, whether they can get a driver's license. There is no training. There's no funding for training. There's no proposed training. Well, there is proposed training in the executive order, but who's going to train the Falmouth officer, police officer, on what the immigration status of the person that they have in front of them is? And for them to then go out and arrest someone, possibly falsely, lock them up, something happens to them, and now the town of Falmouth is going to be sued. Mm-hmm. That's my biggest concern. I practice immigration law every day for the last 25 years. I get phone calls from my employers asking me, is this person legal to work? It takes me an hour to figure out if the person's able to work. And I do this for a living every minute of the day. I can't imagine Falmouth police officers having to do that same, make that same decision at a traffic stop.
Right. Sheriff, you wanted to jump in.
We're talking two different issues here. One is, and I agree, look, I think we all agree, regardless of what side of the issue you're on. Look, Congress has failed for 20 years. I've been involved in immigration reform for 20 years dealing with Washington. And
50
they've
years.
Failed time and time again. I think we all agree on that, and the system isn't where it needs to be. That's why we need reform. But I think more importantly, we have to look at the second piece of this, which is, look, law enforcement officers are responsible for upholding the law. It's not their place to determine or legislate. It's their responsibility. They took an oath to uphold the laws. Any law enforcement officer or any elected official who says we're not going to allow law enforcement to enforce the federal law would essentially tell these officers, you have to commit a felony. If you have somebody in your custody under the U.S. Code, It's a felony under federal law to harbor or conceal anyone you know to be in the country illegally. Federal law supersedes state law. So the officers are obligated to follow the law. If they have somebody that they believe, for example, it just happened in Washington State, a trooper responded to an accident scene. He got both driver's licenses from each driver, ran them. One of them came back and said, this guy is a convicted felon from serious felony. He was deported twice, has reentered the country. Contact ICE. The officer from the accident scene contacted ICE. ICE responded. They arrested the guy. They put him into ICE custody. That trooper the next day was put under investigation for potentially violating policy. So he was left with two choices. Either commit a felony after you've been notified by ICE and allow yourself to harbor and conceal this person by not reporting it to ICE, or do your job, uphold the law, and face disciplinary action by your department up to and including termination for doing your job and fulfilling your oath. Mm-hmm. That's not, in either case, acceptable. We're not going to be, if legislators want the laws changed, have the courage to go and lobby and change them. But don't tell us in law enforcement that we need to turn our backs on the law and undermine our oath, because mm-hmm. we're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I would say to the people who, look, my father came here. He was an immigrant. My father didn't have to walk down the street looking over his shoulder. He did it the right way. And there are a lot of people that came here the right way and followed the law. But we shouldn't be ashamed to say, if somebody was in our backyard and we looked out our window, we want to know why they're there. Does it mean that we're going to arrest them if they didn't belong there? No. It could be somebody that's suffering from dementia or confused, climbed the fence, and they've had a problem. They live in the neighborhood. We might call the police because we don't want to confront the person because we're not sure why they're there. But when the police come and they tell us that this is the case with this guy, then, okay, we're not going to say, well, then arrest him. But if it's somebody that the police determine has got some criminal intentions, well, now the police have an interest, and so does the homeowner. Mm-hmm. So, look, all these people who say people should just be allowed to come here and we should create a class of people who should be forgiven from obeying our laws, well, those same people ought to take down the fences from around their yards here in the United States. And anybody that wants to move from one neighborhood to another, and whether they have a home or they're homeless or whatever, you should have no problem with them setting up a tent in your yard and allow them to make sure they have food, clothing, medical care, electricity if they need it. And it shouldn't be a problem for you, because if you think that that's okay for people to just come in and violate the no trespass orders of our nation, you should have no problem with them violating no trespass orders on your property.
Sheriff, let me ask you this. We mentioned the fear that exists in the immigrant community, parents not sending kids to school, domestic abuse going unreported, or other crimes. There's been an effort from New Bedford police to reach out to this community and in essence, let them know that they can report crimes and not have to fear the police. What is your working relationship with the New Bedford Police Department? Are there differing philosophies here?
Well, look, there's no differing philosophy in the law enforcement community about enforcing laws. We cannot turn our back on the law and start individually, arbitrarily deciding which laws we're going to follow or how much of a law we're going to follow, because then we end up in an anarchy. So in the anarchy.
But Sheriff, you do that every day. Law enforcement does that every day. They make that call. They make that discretionary call on every single crime and every single arrest. They make the discretionary call.
Well, they'll make a discretionary call based on probable cause. If somebody's here illegally, there's no question.
But how do you come to that determination whether someone's illegal without the training?
Well, no. If somebody identifies as foreign-born or you run them in through the computer because you happen to stop and they were involved in suspicious activity, you're not just going to go around looking for people and running people's names. You can't do that. If you come upon somebody, you could be coming to come up on a fight and somebody could be participating in it or part of a group that's there, and when you're checking the IDs of the people there, there's an incident that called you there. If that person comes up as a foreign-born, somebody that potentially is wanted, has some criminal history, they identify themselves as foreign-born, then at that point, it may come back when you run their name that they are wanted. And at that point,
that's not what we're talking about. Sheriff, what we're talking about is the fear. I'm not saying it's a reality, but the fear in the immigrant community that people are being stopped based on suspicion of being illegal without actually engaging in any unlawful criminal conduct.
Where is that happening? Because I'm not aware of that.
No, let's bring in Helena. Helena, you serve these people. Is that accurate? What Matthew Lee is saying?
Yeah, well, yes, of course it is. People are stopping and asking them questions about their immigration status. And that is, and you know, what we say is that no one has the right to ask you about your immigration status. So, and I think that the fear is very legit. And if they're walking, even, you know, and I think the bullying part also is happening, that people in general are now just asking people's immigration, even if they're not officers. So I think we are seeing, people are calling us and telling us that they are being stopped, or if they're even downtown New Bedford, that people are asking for their immigration status. So that is happening. I'm not even just saying with just officers. I think in people in general, look at, especially if we're talking about the Guatemalan population, right? They are, you know, you can, by looking at them, you can tell that where they're from. So their racial profiling about asking people immigration status is happening.
Yeah. Sheriff, I want to ask you about this. Go ahead.
If I could address the Guatemalan thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think Helena knows this. It was told to us and was reported, I think even in the paper, that there were illegals that were coming back from the fish houses walking.
That's right.
Everybody knows they get paid on Fridays.
That's right, and they're getting jumped.
We had predators going down there, jumping these people every Friday, taking the money. When we learned about that, we weren't going down there saying, what is your legal status? We were looking for anybody that was trying to commit a crime against anybody there. We didn't interview those people. We went down and did surveillances trying to see if we could stop and get these predators who were picking, we didn't know who the victims were, and we weren't looking for that. We were looking for, where's the crime happening? And we weren't then saying to the victim, hey, okay, you're illegal, so we're going to lock you up. We were going down there trying to stop the crime. And so I think one of the most important things, though, going forward that we all have to think about is, look, we're debating this issue, but we're all doing it for the same reason. We're angry that Congress has done nothing. We sometimes are debating how it should go, and in the end, it's got to come back to Congress to change these rules. But here's the point. Nobody looks over their shoulders, right, unless they're worried and they know that they've done something wrong. Okay, that's human nature. I don't care if you're an American citizen, you're illegal, what your status is. The reality is, somebody said to me, you know, we're breaking up families by enforcing the immigration laws and so forth. And I said, well, I suppose then you could accuse me of breaking up families too. I've been the sheriff here for 20 years, and I've been housing people in my facility, Americans, who have committed crimes who were separated from their families. The problem we have here is, you could pose that argument, and the same thing with immigration, and blame the system, and you can blame me. But the truth of the matter is, I didn't invite the people to do what they did and end up separating themselves from their family. They did. So we have to make sure that we do everything we can to educate the immigrant community about the proper way to come here, that if you come here under legal status and you are a permanent legal resident, you sign something that shows that you're going to abide by the contract. And if you don't and you violate a part of that contract, like committing a crime against somebody that is a deportable offense, you're likely going to get deported.
All right.
So that's no different than the rules we teach our children in growing up and in school.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's and so the rules have to matter.
Yeah. Sheriff, I'm going to have to leave it there. We got to get on to our foreign worker visa section of the program. But Sheriff Thomas Hodgson from Bristol County, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about immigration directives and changes to the foreign worker visa programs. In studio with us is Matthew Lee, an immigration attorney, also an expert on H-2B visas. We also have Helena Da Silva Hughes on the phone, executive director of the Immigrants Assistance Center. And also joining us on the phone now is Mac Hay of Mac Seafood. Good morning, Mac.
Good morning.
So you and some other folks have gotten together, other businesses, and joined forces to hire a lobbyist to address the H-2B visa program changes that we're having. So for folks who aren't familiar with that, tell us what the H-2B visa program is and how it impacts your business.
The H-2B visa program was actually created in 1952 to bring in foreign workers essentially to supplement temporary or peak load or seasonal need when those positions couldn't be filled in the United States. Obviously, where we are in the Cape, very, very seasonal climate. We have an extremely hard time filling our positions with people that live here locally or even from people that could commute. So that program is essential to our business. It has a annual cap of 66,000 people, or workers, I should say, broken into two halves, so 33,000 for half the year. As you know, that cap, which is why this is big in the news, has been or will be met very shortly, and usually they meaning Congress, provide a returning worker exemption, which means anybody that has been here on the H-2B visa program in the last 3 years is allowed to return. That's not the case this year, and it's caused extreme distress in the you know, business community here on the Outer Cape and basically anybody that uses this program.
Yeah. And we have, what is it? What did you tell me, Matt? 2.7% unemployment rate here?
The unemployment rate, I think,
in Massachusetts, 2.7.
2.7, yeah. So critics of the H-2B visa program say that it takes jobs from American workers. But that is not the case, correct?
Absolutely not. And as Mac knows, he's gone through this process. Under the new regulatory provisions, well, they've been in existence really since 2008, the two changes ago. The employer has to place the job in the Massachusetts Job Bank for 30 days. They have to put it in a newspaper, regional newspaper, for 2 days, including a Sunday. They have to physically post the job in two conspicuous locations at their office. And most critically, they have to offer the foreign worker and U.S. workers that are doing the exact same job the exact same terms of employment, meaning the same wages. And it has to be the prevailing wage, which has been predetermined by the U.S. Department of Labor before you can even start the process. So you have to offer prevailing wages. If you offer the H-2B a flight in, you have to offer the U.S. worker a flight into the country. If you terminate them early, you have to provide their flight home. There is no sane businessman that would engage a lawyer to do the H-2B process if they could find U.S. workers. It's literally a $10,000 to $15,000 to $20,000 additional cost on business to bring in foreign workers at the prevailing wage. It's ridiculous to believe that a sane employer would actually bring in foreign workers at this cost and with uncertainty.
Yeah. Mac, will you be able to meet the summer demand without foreign workers?
Absolutely not. Our business, you know, and I think there's a there's a couple of different discussions that can be had, certainly with regards to this. But if you look at this from a very, macro standpoint, and you step back, if you're trying to create a legitimate business working environment on the Cape Cod, if you're trying to actually create jobs, if you want to be an economic engine and you want to see this area, basically combat the housing crisis by giving people money to buy houses, then you have to have a reliable workforce. The only way to do that in our environment is through a program like this. Now, if there was some other program available where people would be willing to relocate their entire lives for 6 or 9 months of a year and then, leave here and then basically are willing to come back to us, and that's what's very important about this program that I think gets lost, is that many of these H-2B workers return to us year after year because they value their job, they value the work they do, they feel that they're part of our community, not just our Max Seafood business family community, but the community in on the Outer Cape. They make friends here, they become a part of our community. So I think that generally speaking, if you want to survive and establish a legitimate long-term business with a business strategy, with one that intends growth, then you have to have a reliable workforce.
Mindy, why are these jobs unattractive to American workers? I think that's a critical question. It comes up all the time. Every time we've had this mm-hmm. show, somebody calls in. First of all, Max Business, I assume, is open from as soon as you can get workers, let's say April 1st, his seasonal businesses anyways are April 1st until well into Columbus Day, and even a lot of places on the Cape now go into Thanksgiving and even Christmas and New Year's. The American college age or high school age kids all leave for school in the middle of August.
Right.
Okay, every college in America, other than a handful, all start well before Labor Day. They don't get here until end of May. So they've missed the season on the front end, and they're going to miss 2-3 months of employment at the back end where the Cape Cod employers really need them. Housing. For a U.S. worker to move on to the Cape live in dormitory-style housing for 6 months or commute from Boston or from Fall River or New Bedford, it doesn't make any economic sense for $15 an hour or whatever the prevailing wage is.
So let's talk about J-1 visas as well, because J-1s are not supposed to be work visas, but they've sort of become that. This is more of a cultural kind of, you can work, but it's more for a cultural experience, right?
It is. J-1's for foreign exchange students. There are college kids that are currently in school overseas at university in their home country that are allowed to come during their breaks, their winter breaks or their summer breaks to the U.S. They're allowed to come and travel in the U.S., be a tourist or work along the way or work for those 4 months.
Yeah. And is it the process for a J-1 is easier than for the H-2B visa, I would guess?
It is in a sense that you don't have to pay prevailing wage or prove that you can't find U.S. workers. But because of this new enforcement priorities by the Trump administration, it appears that the interviews for J-1 college students to get their J-1 visas at U.S. embassies worldwide is being more and more difficult.
Yeah, I guess on the campaign trail, President Trump vowed to do away with the J-1 program. And currently there's a draft executive order that could delay all J-1 visas 90 days to evaluate security procedures. So it hasn't happened yet, but it could, which has a lot of, I'm sure, J-1 visa folks nervous. Mac, do you use any J-1 visas in your business?
We do. Perhaps every year, maybe ranges from maybe 5 to 10 J-1 mm-hmm. Students. The J-1 visa program is a decent program to use. However, those students that come are, exactly that. They're students. They're mm-hmm. fairly young, relatively inexperienced. Maybe a simple cashier position or something that requires very little training.
Yeah, and they're not coming back.
And that's the other mm-hmm. thing. After, you might have them for 2 years in a row, 2 seasons in a row, but after that, they're not returning, mm-hmm. Which I said is, a big plus of the H-2B program, that the workers that we bring in they're, you know, even though technically it's an unskilled labor position, you know, that's really not, that really does it injustice. These, the workers that come in that we hire, they have to have experience. Particularly, we use cooks and prep cooks and dishwashers. And they're people that are dedicated to their profession, not just looking for a 1 year or 2 year stint.
Yeah. Now, this, I mentioned that you and some other businesses have gotten together and formed this, what, New England Seasonal Business Coalition. You've hired a lobbyist. Where are your efforts at?
Well, that, you know, that was essentially born out of, for lack of a better word, frustration of not, you know, not being able to do anything and feeling like we had our hands tied. Ironically, the lobbyist group had a couple of their members were vacationing in Eastham or had vacation, and they kind of saw our situation, and we just kind of sat down and came up with this idea. The coalition is gaining momentum, which is great to see. You know, obviously, it's, you know, I have a full-time job, and this is an important issue, and we're dedicating quite a bit of time. You know, last week we went up and spoke with the Massachusetts Secretary of Labor, which was really great, facilitated by Jillian Sear and Sarah Peek. It was a really great discussion, but the coalition is gaining momentum, but this is really a federal issue, mm-hmm. and the state pretty much can't help us out. We can raise the issue, but ultimately there's things that sort of work against us. The H-2B program here in Massachusetts is a relatively small user on the national scale. You know, we're less than 2% of the overall H-2B, you know, usage. When it comes to the actual number of employees that we use. So it gets a little bit lost in the shuffle. Congressman Keating has been a huge proponent of us. We've had support from Senator Warren's office. So things are definitely moving forward with the coalition. And what we're trying to do is short-term get the returning worker exemption put back in, meaning bring that the Congress to approve that for fiscal year 2017. But long-term, we need to look at a predictable solution to this issue, you know, either maybe trying to separate the New England seasonal businesses into a different category that would provide a more consistent situation where every year that we weren't reapplying for certification on a yearly basis, perhaps it was a 2 or 3 year certification that would allow us, maybe we could be exempt from the cap.
Yeah.
There are situations like Guam and certain types of businesses like fish roe processing is exempt from the H-2B cap.
Yeah.
So those are the things.
Yeah. We have about a minute left. Matt, maybe you can sum up. We're talking kind of our little corner here, but this really is much bigger.
It is much bigger. If we've got to go to 30,000 feet here. I mean, the bigger issue is, and I agree with the sheriff, the bigger issue is obviously we have to deal with those aliens that we've allowed into the United States and those that are illegally here that are committing crimes. Absolutely. I don't think anyone disagrees that we have to deal first and foremost and get criminal aliens and enforce our laws there. The bigger question is we're not in the process of deporting 13 million illegals. At the end of the day, we're in the process of deporting 13 million workers, and whether that makes sense from an economic standpoint. In Massachusetts, the legal work visa programs are so broken, as you've heard Max say about the H-2B program, the H-1B professional worker program, the J-1, not just seasonal workers, but half the residents and foreign doctors that are doing research and practicing and learning and training at the Boston Hospital are J-1. Massachusetts has more foreign students than any other region in the country. These are the programs that are going to be under attack next.
A lot of work to do here. Matt Kay, Max Seafood, thank you so much. Helena De Silva Hughes, Executive Director of the Immigrants Assistance Center, and Matthew Lee, Immigration Attorney. I wish we had more time. Thanks. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.